Hey, podcast them softly, dry blood. That's what we are talking about at the moment. We had Clint Carney on, the writer, producer, all-round talented guy. Today, though, we have his partner in crime, so to speak. His name is Kelton Jones. He is the director and also one of the stars of this film, that Sean S. Cunningham. That's right, folks. Sean S. Cunningham, the director of Friday the 13th, says writer, star Clint Carney and director Kelton Jones have created a dense edge of your seat. Don't know what's coming next. Horror film. That's very big praise indeed. Dry Blood's available now for streaming on Amazon and Tubi, and can be purchased DVD and Blu-ray from Amazon and Epic Pictures. My guest is the most excellent director and a very creepy sheriff, I must say. Kelton Jones, welcome to Podcasting Them Softly.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
It's fantastic. You know, your performance, have you seen Oliver Stone's U-Turn?
Yeah, it's been a while, but I love that movie.
You strike me as the kind of character that belongs in that town, you know, because what was the place called? Superior, I think it was called. I love the running gag where every time they see Sean Penn's hand, everyone feels the need to say, hey, what happened? Oh, accident. Well, you should be more careful. I really thought that your character was the kind of guy, like, you know, how you doing, buddy? 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 How you doing? I almost thought about having a drinking game every time you said buddy. And I was pretty sloshed by the end of the movie. No, I'm just kidding. But, no, fantastic performance, fantastic film. Kelton Jones, you're a wonderful director. You had a lot of, of course you have some wonderful material to work with, and Clint was, as I opened the interview yesterday with Clint, I said, I've never seen someone decapitate someone with such zeal and enthusiasm.
Yeah, we went through like 5 or 6 children before he finally got it right, but you know, he was pretty happy about that, one.
Lucky there's lots of kids around. But, so tell me, and also, in relation to the question, I was very thrilled to see the making of as well. Usually films, indie films like these don't have such wonderful luxuries of extras and things like that, because all the money goes onto the screen. But it was really great to see the wonderful little documentary, Don't Forget to Kill, or whatever it was. But yeah, it was absolutely a fantastic little addition to watching a wonderful movie. How did you get kicked off in acting, directing, and all the wonderful talents that you exhibit in Dry Blood?
It's really hard to remember when the love of film started, because it goes back so far.
Right.
I kind of feel like I was born with it, but
right.
Yeah, I was I think I was about 7, and I ended up on, you know, watching Sam Peckinpah shoot Convoy when it came in through the small town that I lived in, and was just so taken with the magic of that when I had a chance to work on a film and be in a movie when I was 16, you know, I jumped on it, and then that was just sort of, I was a lifer. You know, sort of like that's what I wanted to do. So I've just spent the last 30 years working on movies and working with great directors and talent and learning everything that I can from them.
Right.
And like all the aspects of it.
Did you go the film school route or learn on the job?
I got a degree back in the early 90s. I got a degree, an art degree with a film and theater emphasis. Mainly I've been working in the industry. So that's been my biggest education, is just getting to work with, like I was one of the visual effects DPs on The Passion of the Christ. So I got to work with Noel Gibson and see how he works, and the genius of the attention that he puts into detail, and Brian Usna worked on The Dentist, and you know, so I got to work with all of these like great horror directors and directors that I grew up watching their films and watching the, you know, their behind the scenes documentaries, you know, and that's one of the best film schools, I think, is really, you know, watching directors' commentaries seeing how people figure out what's ahead of them, you know, what the problems are.
Learn from the masters, why not? Gibbo, we love Gibbo. What was your, the Mel, did you actually meet with Mel Gibson, work for dialogue?
Yeah, so we did the, you know, on Passion of the Christ, they shot all of the stuff there in Spain, but then when they came back, all of the visual effects we did later, and then they worked that into the movie. And so I was on the visual effects team for like 2 months, and so we were shooting all of the torture scenes and the being on the cross and whatnot.
Right. Very powerful.
There was a great moment on that set. One of my favorite set memories is we were filming and we had this 16-foot animatronic Jesus. You know, it was like huge. It was on the cross and whatnot. It was that last scene of the movie, that last shot. And you know, Mel had been getting a lot of flack about the movie, and so he was very self-conscious about that. And we were filming there in Burbank, and I looked, and a semi truck pulled up. You know, this huge lorry pulled up, and it had the words G-O-D. Written on the side of it.
Right.
And so it was on the side of the cab and on the side of the trailer. It was a trucking company, but it was a big red and white truck that said G-O-D on it. And so I went over to Mel, and I was like, hey, Mel, God's here. And he looked at me like I was crazy, and then he peeked through the curtain and saw the truck and actually fell out of his chair laughing.
Like,
it was so funny. The idea that God would show up on the set and to check in on him, and he would show up in a truck with his name on it.
That's a great story. Well done. Mel Gibson, Gibbo. We love Gibbo. The Road Warrior, Braveheart, you know, Lethal Weapon. I mean, and the man turned out to be an exceptional filmmaker. I mean, like anyone who gets into this business, and like you were just saying before, learn from the best. And I mean, he got to learn from guys like Richard Donner, and you know, I mean, it's really, you know, people sometimes are a little bit skeptical when actors step behind the camera, because they're probably predominantly known as actors and movie stars. So when they decide to direct, it's kind of like, oh, ho hum, here we go, right? Don't you think?
Right.
Don't you think there's that stigma? Do you think that still exists, or is it a bit more accepted today?
You know, I think a lot more actors are becoming great directors. Like, it's becoming more and more common. Olivia Wilde just did a movie, and it was quite well received.
Yeah, it was a great film.
And I think there's a bigger understanding. You know, there used to be much more of a mystery of process, and I think that's why, you know, actors were sort of reticent to get in, because they would only see their side of it. They would see their character work, and then they'd show up on set, and everything was done. So, you know, they weren't there for the pre-production, and they weren't there for the part of where all of the real work happens, which is in the story writing and then the figuring it out. Like, by the time you're on set, most of the work is done. You just have to kind of get through it.
Right.
And so I think a lot of people are much more aware of that now. But that was one of the great things about working with Mel, is that he was so involved. Like, we did the test, actually, for that movie. We did all the visual effects tests for that a year before they even started shooting. So, like, he had done massive amounts of research on how to do it. And the effect that we had used had never been done before. So we were, like, really breaking new ground with that movie.
Yeah. And he was very brave to tackle that, and in some of the original languages, but also the poignancy of that film. I mean, a lot of people spoke about the violence. I remember coming out of the cinema and hearing people go, oh my God, that was violent. And I said, well, you think Jesus hanging on the cross when he was up there, he thought it was fun? Come on. I mean, if you read the Bible, I mean, he bore the sins of the world on his back. So, I mean, this is the visual incarnation of that, like bearing the sins, or bearing all of the turmoil or the world in crisis on your back, literally, and being tortured for other people's crimes and misdemeanors and whatever else. But it is more impactful as a complete picture, not just the violence. There's not just one element of that movie that is poignant. The whole thing is poignant, and Mel Gibson is a man of, I think, great faith, and certainly knows where to put a camera. So, yeah, incredible stuff. Great story, too. God is here. Why not? God's outside the door, Mel. Really? Well,
you've got to make sure you're doing this right.
Yeah. Tell him we're here to. Tell him we're busy. Can you just wait outside, and I'll grab a cup of coffee in the commissary at a later date with him.
I'll meet him at craft service.
Yeah. Tell him I'll be outside for a cigarette in like half an hour, and we'll have a chat then. But Acting and directing, is it tough or easy?
It's hard. It's very hard. Yeah. it's amazing, but everything that you do, it's about, trying to go deeper, trying to push past your comfort levels, trying to be more specific, trying to, make it better. Like everything that you can do to serve the story and make it better. It's an interesting process, because in the process you really lose like yourself, you lose your ego, you lose all of that, because it becomes so much about serving the art. And that's can be a pretty brutal process sometimes, but it really, there's a lot depending on you to tell the story, and you have a responsibility to the audience and to the people who've invested in you to make a good story. So that's where you put all your focus.
Do you believe that knowing how to act make you a better writer and director?
I do personally. I think that all three of those sort of inform each other. Like the directing experience makes me better when I'm acting, and my acting experience makes me a lot better director, because it helps me in understanding the nuance of the character, and it helps me communicate with the other actors, and to understand and respect their process, which is a big part of it too. To be able to communicate with them. That's always the challenge, with working with any actor, is that you want to communicate what you're trying to create, but you don't want to step on their creative process in a way that makes them, defensive or closed down or want to fight you.
Does it certainly would help too to have a group of people like you did around you. Making Dry Blood with Clinton, of course, all your family was involved, and his family was involved, and you had a lot of people that you had a shorthand with and great association with. That certainly must make it easy when you have to set up a shot and then you have to switch into actor mode and become this fantastic character that you were. That must make it a little bit easier, to then step away from the camera and just trust that everyone behind the camera is just going to do their job and you can act the heck out of it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's really the trick to making films, especially on an indie film level, is that you work with people that you trust their opinion and their artistic skills, and you support them, and you make sure that you're moving in the same direction, but you let them surprise you. You let them come up with great ideas, or you let trust them to do what it is that you've brought them on to do.
I think
the more that you can do that, the better product you get.
Sure. I believe it was Clint in the little making of documentary that was fantastic. Is that on the Blu-ray? Is that going to be on the release?
Yeah, that's on the Blu-ray version.
Okay, that's cool. Yeah, no, because when David sent me all the material, it was on there. I just thought, oh, that's nice. But so I hope if people buy the Blu-ray, definitely check it out. But I believe it was Clint that said on the documentary that in order to make a small movie look or appear more, not so much more expensive, but bigger than it actually is, you really do require the assistance of people. I mean, sometimes there's a lot of people on indie films that aren't making any money, but they really are there for the passion of cinema. I heard Quentin Tarantino talking about, I think it was actually a clip from the making of Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. You seen Once Upon a Time in Hollywood?
I haven't had a chance to see that yet.
No. Oh, okay. Definitely get to see that when you can, because truly a masterwork, masterclass in writing and directing from him. But he said they were doing a take, and he says, we're going to do one more because it's a movie and we love making movies. You need people around you with a lot of passion, and that definitely helps elevate the material, yeah?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, especially in indie world, like a lot of us work on bigger productions or on commercials or on, other things that we may not feel that full passionate about, because it's someone else's product, or it's something that you're a little removed from the creative side of it. But when we have the opportunity, even though we're making less money on these indie films, that's the thing we get to put our heart in. Like, ultimately, everyone that I know, we make movies because we love movies, and we want there to be great movies out there, and we're fans. And so, getting to do the thing that was such a big part of our life, especially growing up, it's kind of magical, and that's why we're in it. All of the stuff about, making a living at it is so that you can do the thing that you love and do it better.
So the question that's burning a hole in my back pocket is, where did that character come from? Did you know a guy like that, or is that Sheriff somewhere inside Kelton Jones?
For the sheriff? A little bit. Like, I grew up in Texas, and so, like, the police in Texas kind of have that sort of calm, you know, good old boyness to them, but, you know, they're just putting you off guard. And so, like, that's a technique. That's actually a law enforcement technique where, you know, you make somebody feel at ease so that they slip up so that you can catch them.
Right.
You know,
right.
And so, like, a lot of it, you know, a lot of the things that the cop is doing is to keep Brian off balance, because he recognizes him immediately as, like, being a shifty character. Like, you don't know what this guy did, but you know he's no good.
Right.
And you know you don't want him in your town. So at the very least, you want him to leave town.
Yeah.
So that he doesn't become a problem for you. So it's, you know, really, he's just doing damn good police work. That's what a lot of it is.
Yeah, sure.
But Clint's father, who was a sheriff's deputy himself, who was the sergeant and the sheriff's deputy, he was there on set with us. And so he was my technical advisor. So I was constantly going to him about, like, how the uniform is supposed to be and you know, the procedure and how do you approach a vehicle and all of these little tips that he was giving me that were procedural stuff is part of what helped me make that character more realistic. Because I played that character thinking of the police officer who's going to watch the movie and recognize, oh yeah, this guy's a real cop, as opposed to, oh, this is an actor playing a cop.
Right. But I think there was some nice little flourishes. I mean, I think my absolutely favorite part of your performance is a little moment where you didn't really say anything. It's Clint that reacts to you. You say something and then there's kind of a pause and he says, "You've got your hand on your gun." We're talking about movies, and in talking about pure cinema, great moments in Dry Blood where it drifts away from a really good horror movie and into pure cinema with moments like that, because pure cinema is all about the image and people really listening and really reacting, which is the secret to acting, yeah?
Yeah, yeah. I'm a big fan of the Meisner technique, so that's very much part of that.
Yeah.
That belief system.
Yeah, I mean, that's I just, for my money, I don't want to spoil too much of the movie because I want people listening to go watch it. But yeah, that one moment, and people will know it. They mightn't have the same impact that I did, but I just thought it was a great moment. I thought that initial banter between you two, and then it kind of just keeps going for a little while, which I think is great. Also, too, I absolutely love the bit where you get your face desiccated, as it were. That looked severely gruesome, of course, with the aid of visual effects, but you had quite a lot of, as it said in the documentary, you had quite a lot of prosthetic on, too, as well as being aided by visual effects.
Yeah, that certainly helps. And it helps that I was actually drowning on the blood.
Right.
The one of the blood tubes was aimed in such a way that it was great when I was standing up, but when I laid down, it shot the blood right up my nose. And
oh,
so I was actually choking on, you know, a huge, you know, huge squirt of the blood, the fake blood, as I was doing the scene, but I didn't want to bust the take. So I was like, well, hopefully we can finish the take before I actually pass out.
Right. There you go. There's your next directorial effort, a vampire movie, I Snort Blood. There you go.
Exactly.
I'll write it for you. All right, but there was a question I asked Clint yesterday, and it was in the press material that David sent me, and it's actually a quote from yourself. "We wanted to make a film that was true to the genre and lived up to the potential of what a great horror film could be." Now, in my conversation with Clint, I said, you know, there are a lot of, in horror movies in particular, there are a lot of tropes that people regard as cliche, yet fans of horror expect them in the film, even though they go, "Oh, that's so typical of a horror movie." But they are marks that you have to hit, because there is a rhythm to cinema, just like there is a rhythm to music, and horror films, just like certain music, has a particular beat and a rhythm. Rock songs sound like rock songs. R&B sounds like R&B. Action movies are like action movies, or as George Miller once said, they are essentially the rock and roll equivalent of cinema. So how do you feel in with that statement in mind, the music of the horror film, do you personally, or did you, as the director, I know Clint talked about it from the perspective as the writer, actor, all that kind of side of things, but from the director's point of view, those tropes and cliches that some people moan at because, oh, geez, that was typical, I knew he was going to get killed, but you kind of got to have, you've kind of got to have someone to keep it in that, the potential for being what a great horror film could be.
Yeah, we didn't, we weren't trying to recreate necessarily any tropes. We weren't trying to do anything that we had seen.
Right.
We were just trying to best serve the story. So, you know, a lot of it's like what's happening in the script and how do we, you know, best explore the character.
Right.
So, a lot of times I know that you can be very conscious about, like, oh, we have to have this moment, or we have to have the girl trips on the way to escape, you know, to build that audience thing, because that's an expectation, I guess. But we didn't really play that much into those, as much as because we watched, you know, so many of those films growing up, and all the time we're constantly watching horror films and great movies, that it gets sort of in your DNA. So it just sort of comes out in the way that you express without having to be specifically conscious of it.
Right.
So, you know, for us, it was about like, what does the story need, and what serves the story more than what did somebody else do? So like, we never made a conscious effort to copy what anybody else had done.
Right. But I mean, like you said, you are aware that, okay, yeah, we do need certain moments, you know, for the rhythm of this film to work. At least
basic story structure and narrative arc, yeah.
Yeah, because I mean, because this film really starts as kind of a slow boil. Do you agree? I mean, it builds.
Yeah, absolutely, and that was actually one of the things that we talked at great length about, because that was a huge risk on our part that, you know, frankly, we didn't know if that was even going to work, like, because with the modern audience, you know, people are used to having something exciting happen in that first few minutes that hooks you, and then something, you know, 10 minutes into the movie that happens that hooks you. So to have a movie that has the slow kind of build the way that they used to back in the 70s and early 80s, it's kind of a risk to do something like that now, because you're going to have a lot of audience that's not into that, and they're going to turn it off and go, oh, this is boring, and they don't know what they're doing.
Sure.
So we knew that we would lose a good percentage of our audience in that path, but it's what felt right for the story, and it was something that we really wanted to do in order to build that sense of dread and that understanding of the character, and you know, we were trying to do something bigger.
Yeah.
You know, whether or not it worked, you know, depends on the audience perception of it. But.
Yeah, it's fortuitous that you mentioned that, because I was about to say that, you know, the modern audience are used to, you know, sock wham pow at the start of the movie. But when we talk about classic movies now, like, for instance, Jaws or even Aliens, both films are very much a slow build. I know that there's a death right at the start of Jaws, but the shark is elusive. I mean, the shark is elusive right until, you know, he pops up, and, you know, when Roy Scheider's saying, you know, come down here and chum some of this shit, right?
Right.
Right. And the same with Aliens. Like, you start off with Sigourney Weaver having nightmares about the alien coming out of her chest. But we really don't get into the alien onslaught until they enter the hive, so to speak, in the base of the cooling towers, or the wherever they had the people. But so, you know, it has become, don't you think, something that audiences have been conditioned, haven't they? I mean, it's not really people have gone away from it. They're conditioned by mainstream cinema to want, you know, the bells and whistles right up front. They don't want to wait for it.
Yeah, I think there's an expectation, but also in having so much content that's in a short form, you know, with, Vine's not around anymore, but you still have the Instagram stories, or you still have, like, the YouTube stories and things where you have short little clips where you can sort of consume little bites of information and decide whether or not you want to continue with something, you know.
Yeah.
And so, like, you're always, you know, with television, you always have to, you have to get them hooked so that they don't switch to another channel. You
right,
know, you have
right,
to,
right, right,
you know,
right.
keep them so that they don't leave during the commercial break or whatever.
Sure, So
those have different requirements that if you can get somebody in a theater, you can get them to sit and watch. But now that, you know, everything's on streaming, you know, if you don't catch somebody with a movie, if they're not interested in 5 minutes, they're on to another movie because they have, you know, 15 different streaming services that they can get, you know, a great classic movie on. So they're not going to have the patience a lot of times to sit through a film.
I just actually come off writing a horror film, so that's why it's kind of fortuitous that I'd be reviewing and doing the interviews for a horror film, because as I said to Clint, I mean, I like horror films. They're not what I go to all the time with cinematically. So I just recently come off writing a horror film that's going to be made next year, and I kind of ran into the same problem that we've been discussing. The director read the first draft and he said, oh, no, we need the monster up front. We need to, you know, if we don't have the monster up front, they're not going to know it's a monster movie. And and I was like, oh, really? You don't want to have it be a surprise? He said, no, just like you said, he said, the people watching these movies, you need to you need to grab them. Let them know it's a horror movie, like, in the first, like, 5 minutes. Otherwise, you know, you run the risk of them, like you said, either changing channels or going to watch The Mandalorian or something like that.
Right.
But, you know, so, plus I didn't have enough boobs in it. So I had to go back and put more boobs, because it's one of those boobs blood. Monsters, boobs,
right,
and
right.
blood kind of exploitation type movies. But there's an interesting premise in there too, but he said, you know, ultimately this is that kind of movie. But Dry Blood really isn't that kind of movie. Dry Blood's more of a psychological horror, isn't it?
Much more so. And you know, we were playing with a lot of ideas of you know, the idea of what is a ghost. You know, is a ghost something that you create in your own mind, or is it something that's real? And you know, I don't know that necessarily gets answered in this story. So it's really up to the viewer to decide for themselves. Like, you know, were those ghosts real, or was that something that was he was creating?
Right. Yeah. No, but it's a fantastic movie. So what now that you've conquered the horror movie, where does Kelton Jones go next with his marvelous directorial vision? Do you have more on the way that fans who are definitely going to love this movie are going to want to see more movies now, Kelton? Have you got certainly things down the road that we're going to see another Kelton Jones film or a Kelton Jones performance or?
I've got several projects. I just finished doing a production of King Lear that I was an actor in.
Fantastic.
I played Gloucester.
Right.
So if anybody who came to saw that got to see me get my eyes gouged out and try to commit suicide and, you know, all the fun things that, you know, you get to do with Shakespeare.
I actually played King Lear in university, so it was...
You know, that was a great, great play to do.
It is a
fantastic
play.
And then there's another film that I'm the lead in called The Evil Down the Street, which is on Amazon. That came out this year as well.
Okay.
But right now I'm writing one that's more of a, more in line with like a Noah Baumbach type film, you know, you know, kind of family, comedy, drama,
right.
kind of.
Squid and the Whale type deal.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
Like that kind of vibe.
But
a little more like Wes Anderson kind of, you know, it's a fucked up family stuff. You know,
but quirky, Royal Tenenbaums is
right. Okay. Yeah, I like things that have a humor to them, but are based in a reality. Like, so even for me, like, to me, Dry Blood's kind of a really funny movie in a lot of ways.
Right.
You know, because you've got that sort of
a dramedy.
Dark
what do they,
humor
what do they
to
call it?
It?
What's the word now? Dramedy.
Dramedy. Yeah,
dramedy,
I think that's a.
Yeah. But, well, that's great. Look, I wish you all the best, mate. It's a fantastic performance, a fantastic film. One quote was a disturbing, nightmarish exploration. In addition, about addiction, paranoia, and horror, Dry Blood is a great film. Dry Blood is an enjoyable mindfuck of a movie, says searchmytrash.com. I have to agree with them. It is an enjoyable mindfuck of a movie. It's an enjoyable movie. And I've had the great pleasure to talk to Clint Carney and today the marvelous director and actor, Kelton Jones. Kelton Jones, we wish you all the best with your future projects. I look forward to the next Kelton Jones performance, the next Kelton Jones film, and I hope it all goes well. I hope Dry Blood gets out there. People, get out and see it. Kelton Jones, I have one request before I let you go. Can you do the sheriff for me? Can you say, go out and see Dry Blood, everyone, buddy?
Hey, buddy. You go out there and check out Dry Blood. I didn't say anything.
That's fantastic. Dry Blood, you can get it now. Available. It's available for streaming on Amazon. Tubi can be purchased on DVD and Blu-ray from Amazon and Epic Pictures. You can see my friend Kelton Jones and Clint. Marvelous performances. Wonderful writing. Wonderful direction. Dry Blood. Epic. Horror. Get it now. Kelton Jones, thank you for being on Podcasting Them Softly.
Thank you so much. And it's also, the vinyl is available through Burning.
Oh, that's right. I forgot about that. Because I was on Epic, the Epic website the other day. Yes, vinyl is back, people. I believe there was an article recently that vinyl, I think, outsold CDs for the first time since forever. I've recently ordered my Big Trouble in Little China special edition to get the green vinyl.
Nice.
Wow.
That's incredible. Awesome.
But yeah, get the vinyl. Get the Dry Blood, because the score is really good too. We haven't really talked about the score because, you know, we're talking about acting and directing in the movie and everything. But yes, the score is really nice, creepy, irisome, very moody, very, very fitting. But yeah, so get out there. You find that on Epic Pictures website, all the information with that, and of course Amazon. And yeah, but thanks again, mate. Really, really cool stuff, and all the best with your future projects. Hey.
Thank you, and good luck with your script. Let me know when it...
Like yourself, I've been, it's been 30 years in the making getting to this point. When you live in a galaxy far, far away from Hollywood, as I do, 9,000 miles away, it's kind of hard, but I've managed to sort of Paul Schrader my way into Hollywood by writing about movies and talking to people who make movies, and I eventually found a director that was susceptible to suggestion. He gave me a shot. He said, look, if you can, he said, you sound like you do a great job writing your own stuff, but if you can write this movie for me, I want to make it anyway, so you're going to save me time writing the script myself if you can do it. So yeah, I wrote it over a weekend, and how's your father? It's going into production next year, so well done me.
But congratulations, yeah, that's fantastic.
It takes, as you know, it takes a while. You're as much a fan as you are a student. You never stop learning in this game, is that right?
Yeah, that's a nail in the head.
Yeah, you never stop learning. Nail in the coffin, and don't forget about the Dry Blood. Thanks, Kelton, mate. It's been an absolute pleasure, and we'll catch you later on.
All right, thanks a lot. Great talking to you.
All right, mate. Cheerio. Bye-bye.